All right, welcome. Committee on Health and Human Services Finance will come to order. We do not yet have a quorum, or do we? We do have a quorum. And with that, Representative Albright moves approval for the minutes of January 10th. Any additions, corrections, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Minutes are approved. Today we have the presentation by the Minnesota Department of Health. We have Commissioner Ed Elliar. I think some information is being passed out right now, which is the PowerPoint that Dr. Elliar will go through. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Good. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Ed Elliar, the Commissioner of Health. It's nice to see some familiar faces in this committee, and it's nice to see some new faces. And so I will, during this presentation, sort of go through some background of the Minnesota Department of Health and the role that we play, and then invite some of my assistant commissioners to go through their parts of the department in a little bit more detail. It's really great to be here, and I usually start with this quotation from Paraphilus of Chalcedon, who's the physician to... And this quotation from the physician to Alexander the Great, you know, a couple of thousand years ago. When health is absent, wisdom cannot reveal itself, art cannot become manifest, strength cannot fight, wealth becomes useless, and intelligence cannot be applied. It is the feeling behind this is why I am so pleased to be the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, which I believe, and I'm biased, is one of the best state health departments in the country. And because the work that we do, I think, actually impacts, and the work that you do as part of the public health team, impacts everything that goes on in state government. Without health, we will not have a vibrant economy. Without good health, we will not have children advancing and adults advancing in school. Without good health, we will not have a stable environment. Health is crucial to everything that we do. So there's a little bit of background. You may wonder why a physician, I'm boarded in internal medicine and pediatrics, why I gave up seeing patients in clinic to run a health department. And it really comes from the fact that during my first job, I was going to be a GP in a rural community. And so I started practice in Shelby, Montana, a long time ago. And it took me within the first couple of months of being very busy, seeing 30, 40, sometimes 50 patients a day, to realize that I could be doing that every day for the rest of my life, seeing patients and actually making an impact on the life of that individual that came into the clinic. But I really wouldn't impact the health of the community. There were too many other factors in the community that were really impacting health. Alcohol, tobacco, unsafe work environments, unsafe water and air, lack of access to good food, and realized that if I was going to really have an impact, would really need to look more upstream in terms of public health work to change those conditions in which people were living. As important as medical care is, which I think it is very important, we need to do more, and that's when I really became interested in public health. And it was also at that time that I realized how important it was for local communities to take ownership and control over the environments in which people lived and set policies and systems in place that really set the tone for good health in their communities. And that's why every summer I do go around the state pitching horseshoes with county commissioners and local officials and local public health folks to really talk about what it is that they need in their local communities to create a healthy community. What we can do at the state, what they can do at the local level, how can we partner? And so that really is the bottom line of what we do in the state health department. Now, Minnesota, as you're well aware, is a really healthy state. We're the fourth healthiest state in the nation, according to the United Health Foundation's state health rankings. We have the second longest longevity in the country. We have the number one health care system in the country. And many of the things that we're doing, I can't take credit for a lot of those, or, you know, the current department. A lot of what the health that we have today is because of the investments that were made 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so I think my job is to take advantage of those investments that were made in improving health and also work with you to make sure that we try to do the right kind of investments now. I'm at a stage in my life where I'm not even worried about my children anymore. They're in their 40s and doing quite well. I'm really worried about setting the tone for my grandchildren and sometime maybe my great-grandchildren. We're setting that kind of thing in place. So given that, we are a healthy state. There are some challenges that we have. We have an aging population and with the needs that an aging population brings. We have rising rates of chronic disease that goes along with the aging that we do. We have obesity and diabetes. We have new things like the opioid crisis that is really affecting communities throughout the state, both urban and rural. And we have barriers to access to care, particularly things as I go around the state, access to mental health services and oral health care, things that are really important. But also one of the things that we hear is the fact that we have rising costs. Our health care costs are rising. And this slide that we have here really, I think, dramatizes the impact that I found out really early on in my career. The line there where that's kind of flattening out, that's the United States. On the long, the horizontal axis, the farther you go to the right, is the amount of dollars we spend on health care. On the vertical axis, as you go up, it's longevity. And you can see that the United States has departed from the rest of the industrialized country. We are continually spending more and more on health care, and yet our payback in terms of longevity has really fallen far behind other countries. This highlights the fact that we cannot treat our way into health. And that is certainly what I found is in terms of community. Yes, you can have an impact on an individual with care, but overall, our overall health care statistics as a state will not improve just by medical care. And that's really why the state health department really is looking at all of the other determinants of health. Now, and particularly, I think this next slide that shows why we're in the situation that we're in. This is looking at all total health and human services spending from industrialized countries throughout the world. And you can see that overall, total health and human services dollars that the United States spend, which is farther down on that list, is not at the top of the list. In fact, we're down in the bottom 25%. But the difference is that blue line, that's the medical component, the clinical care component of our funding, far outweighs our spending on public health and human services. We are unique in the world in terms of that we spend, for every dollar we spend in health care, we only spend about 55 cents on public health and social services. Other industrialized countries who on that previous slide are having increases in their longevity far above ours, for every dollar they spend on health care, they spend two on public health and human services. And so I think we have to really think, and that's sort of what I do, is how do we invest? How do we do the right kind of balance to make sure that we focus on the things that really make a difference? And that's what we're trying to do with our budget and with our programs. Now, like I said, Minnesota, as I rip off from Garrison Keillor, where women are strong, the men are good-looking, and all our health statistics are above average, unless you're a person of color or an American Indian. And we have some of the greatest life expectancy differences in the country. We have some of the various disparities that really affect people of color and American Indians, low-income communities, rural communities. And that's where we really want to focus some of our efforts. That's why we've made health equity one of the platforms on which we build all of our activities. And so, but you have to be aware that health is not about averages, and health equity is not about averages. It's really about creating opportunities to be healthy. And our Advancing Health Equity report that we submitted to you in 2014 highlighted the fact that the opportunity to be healthy is not available everywhere for everyone in our state, that some people enjoy more opportunities for health. And we're really there to really kind of take the approach that we want everybody to have the opportunity to be healthy, regardless of where you live, regardless of your income, regardless of your educational level, regardless of your race. That is the focus of our Advancing Health Equity Report. We want everybody to have the opportunity to be healthy. And it highlights this fact that it's not about equality. And this little graphic shows that it's not spreading things out equally. It's actually, what are the opportunities available to different people with their different needs? I argue that I don't treat my two kids exactly the same because they have different needs, they have different goals, they have different talents, they have different opportunities. They try to treat them equitably so that they can both be successful. I think that's what we're trying to do in this state, to try to give everybody the opportunity to be healthy. And to do that, we take what we put together called the triple aim of health equity. This is where we really say we have to do our work differently. We can't just continue to focus on the way we've always done our work, as important as that was. We've done some really good things over the years in terms of creating conditions where infectious diseases are not affecting everyone, where we have clean water and clean air and clean food. But we're really saying to address the new issues that we have in our society today, we have to do our work differently. And that means we have to do the three things in the triple aim. Broaden our understanding of what creates health. It is not just about medical care and personal choices, but it's really about the living conditions, the socioeconomic conditions in which people live, work, and go to school. Secondly, we need to have a health in all policies approach with health equity as a goal. Health is not just the responsibility of the health care sector or the public health sector. Really, health is impacted by transportation and housing and economic development and our criminal justice system and education. All of those factors have to take their role in creating health. And thirdly, we have to create the capacity for communities to create their own healthy future. We really want to make sure that communities are at the table working, owning the issue of health, and really focusing on local issues, local strategies to address health. And so that triple aim of health equity is what we're focusing all of our work on. And that first part of that triple aim, expanding our understanding of what creates health, really is something that is new to most people. Most people believe the dominant narrative is that, you know, clinical care, health care, is the most important thing in terms of your health. But the data show that clinical care really is only about 10% of our overall health. Really impacts that. It's really important. And as a physician, somebody who's treated patients for many years and has worked in hospitals and intensive care units, I want to have the best health care system we have. And that's why we continue to work with you on improving the health care system. And I believe we do have, I'm biased here in Minnesota. I think we have the best health care system in the country. And we want to keep it that way and want to make it even better. But that by itself is not going to create health. Really, we need look at the health behaviors, which are about 30%, the physical environment, about 10%, genes and biology, about 10%, but really have to look at the social conditions in which people live, which is about 40%. That means, you know, looking at housing and looking at education and looking at nutrition and looking at the economic system in which we live. Broadband connectivity is one of those things also. So those are the factors that we're really looking at in expanding our understanding of what creates health. So in that first part of the triple aim, expanding our understanding, it's really starting to have that conversation about changing the narrative about what creates health. And I hope that we can have conversations with you over the course of this session to really talk more about what creates health and so that we can really create the investments that will make that happen. And so what we do is working with that triple aim and with this broad understanding, we really take the role of sort of the chief health strategist. And that's the term that we were talking about in terms of public health. You know, we're the chief health strategist. We're here to really look at the health department, to really look at what the needs are in the community, what the resources are in the community, what are the opportunities in communities throughout our state, who are the players that need to be at the table, what kind of strategies can we use to move forward. And I think it's appropriate that we're here meeting today on the 53rd anniversary of Luther Terry issuing the Smoking and Health Report in 1964, which was part of the chief health strategist approach, identifying this as a need, and then talking about what do we need to do throughout our communities, throughout our states, throughout the country, to really have an impact on tobacco use. And it takes a long time to make those kinds of changes. So I'm not one who say we're going to be able to do something in the next year or the next 2 years. I hope we can do some things in that period of time, but we really need to take that long-term view. And as the chief health strategist, we work with local agencies, we work with other state agencies, we work with community groups to really look at our public health infrastructure, look at the systems that are in place, the policies that are in place, and how can we move things forward. And certainly we want to maintain the traditional public health infrastructure that we've had for a long time. We want to have clean water. We want to have clean air. We want to have safe food. We want to really make sure that we have immunizations for people who need it. Those are the traditional public health activities. And we need to have those in place because we're seeing a lot of new kinds of threats, certainly just within the last several years, the Zika virus, Ebola virus, avian influenza, antibiotic-resistant pathogens. These are things, infectious diseases, that are really coming forward that we can't predict, and we have to have the systems in place to deal with that. The H1N1 epidemic that we had, the pandemic that we had back in 2009, came out of the blue really quickly, and we had to respond quickly for that. That can happen at any time. We're in a global environment, and we know that some of these diseases may be just a plane ride away. So we really need to focus on that. So we need to have our traditional public health roles in place to do that. But we also have some newer challenges, you know, chronic diseases and aging, climate events, interpersonal violence, disparities. All of those are affecting the health in our community. So we need to come together as a chief health strategist to pull people together, the right kind of data together, the right kind of folks together, look at the opportunities to make a difference. And this is where I really look to, as I say, go around the state, working with county commissioners and working with city council members and working with local public health to say, what are the issues? What are the opportunities that we have? How can we partner with you to do that? So that is what we're doing. Also, I think the issue about equity is one of those things that we really have to pay attention to. I talked about the fact that we have some disparities in our state that are greater than in many other states. And it's really, and really being fairly crass about it, it's a math problem. As we become an increasingly diverse state, when I moved to Minnesota in 1980, we had 2% people of color and American Indians. We're now up to 19% and rising rapidly. 35% of second graders are kids of color and American Indians. So, like I say, crassly, it's a math problem. If we don't deal with those disparities, our average is going to come down. But in reality, it's a social justice problem. It's a community problem. It is an issue that we want as a commonwealth, as a community of the whole, we want everybody to be healthy, to have that opportunity to be healthy. So that's why we really have been focusing on health equity. And this is an issue that is not just here. It's throughout the country. And people are recognizing what we're doing here. As we talked about broadening our understanding, we have really changed the conversation about health equity. It is a topic in this state and many agencies, both at the local and at the state level. It's a topic nationally, and people are looking to Minnesota to see how we're doing with addressing health equity. And I have to admit that one of the things as chief strategist, we have brought a lot of money into the state to deal with health equity. It doesn't come to the department, but it comes to the University of Minnesota. Got a large grant. Because of the work that we're doing in health equity, they got a grant to study health equity. And so this is the kind of thing that we're doing. Other local community groups have gotten funding from other national foundations because of the work that we're doing with them in terms of health equity. So the investments that we're making, that you're making in us, sometimes have broader implications beyond just what is brought back to the state health department. I can't remember which direction I'm going here on my page. So we play a huge role, I believe, in doing that. And that's why we're here to really talk about our budget. We have a budget of $1.2 billion, about 1,500 staff. We're the fifth largest executive branch agency by budget. And we already have a strong infrastructure. As I talked about, you know, the proven capabilities that we've had with dealing with Zika and with foodborne illnesses. I'm really proud of the work that we do in tracking down foodborne illnesses, and I think the country as a whole benefits from our work. Our environmental health work around reducing threats to water and food and air quality, and our nationally regarded public health laboratory, and the fact that we are an accredited health organization, accredited by the Public Health Accrediting Board, says that we really are at the top of our game working on what's going on. And we don't do this in isolation. We do this with our county, our health departments, community health boards throughout the state. There are 51 community health boards. And we have our statewide community health services advisory committee in each of your communities. And I hope you get to know the representatives on what we call SHAC, the statewide community health service agency. These are people in your area, oftentimes county commissioners, who really know what's going on. They know about health. They know about public health. There are great resources. I tell them, county commissioners, they are my best public health friends because they have the ability at the local community to really invest in a health and all policies approach. And so I really want to learn from them and see what's working at the local level. But we also know not just our local partners, but public health is an enterprise. We need a strong federal presence in public health. We need CDC to be really strong. We need state government public health to be really strong, and we need local public health to be really strong. And we need to have good collaborative relationships with public health-focused agencies, not just governmental public health, but broadly defined public health agencies in local communities, the not-for-profits that are working, the volunteer groups that really are working on public health efforts. And we do this throughout the state. Both certainly from what we do in St. Paul here from the Minnesota Department of Health and the Freeman Building and the Golden Rule Building, but also through our district offices throughout the state. And this is where we have technical experts who are out there really offering technical assistance and support and ideas to community health boards throughout the state. And as I, you know, I have to admit, there's always this, and budget issues, there's always the question, should we get rid of the district offices? And as I go around the state, that is one thing I hear from folks throughout the state. No, leave the district office because we really depend on that public health nurse to really help us out. We really expect that environmental health specialist, the sanitarian, to be there to help us with it. The emergency preparedness folks. This is hands-on in the community as best we can, providing support to folks. And so those 10 district offices, or 8 district offices, are really important. So we have great partners throughout the state. And now let's look at the next slide here to show really our base budget as I get into some of the more details of our budget. This is our base budget, $1.2 billion for the biennium. You can see that only 16% of our budget is general fund. The majority of our dollars come from the federal government, 44% of our dollars. And, you know, we're applying for grants all the time. Because we're so dependent on federal dollars, we really are a grant-getting operation. We're really looking at dollars as often as we can to really help do that. We've received 104 distinct awards in 2016, totaling $235 million. So we really focus a lot on that. The remainder of our budget is really in fees and some other sources of health care access fund. Like I said, only 16% from the general fund. If you look at the categories of our spending, you know, over half of our dollars go out the door. They go to the local communities in terms of grants. The other 24% are for personnel and other operating, the 21% for other operating funds. So that we're not building our own empire, our own staff. We're really trying to build local public health, local community efforts for that. Here's the funding for our staff. Again, 10% for the general fund, 35% federal. Fees support 21% of our dollars or of our staff. And just as an example, and this is particularly important right now when at the federal level they're talking about the Affordable Care Act and getting rid of the Affordable Care Act. And most people think about the Affordable Care Act as the health care piece of it. But part of the Affordable Care Act was they had put in the Prevention Public Health Fund, which really funds a lot of public health activities. And my most recent intelligence is that might be going away, which would be a huge hit to public health at the federal level and at the local level. And since we're so dependent on federal dollars, we're really concerned about that. These are the places where we get our grants. It doesn't all come from one place. It doesn't all come from CDC. Certainly the biggest grant that we have is from the Department of Agriculture for WIC, which really benefits everybody throughout the state, every community throughout the state. That's our largest. But then for CDC, you talk about some of the lack of flexibility. We get 60 awards from CDC, and these are categorical funds, which really are targeted to one kind of issue, so we have to focus on those issues. So we don't have a lot of flexibility in dealing with a variety of issues to be able to be nimble and move to other things. We have to be focused on what those grants. HRSA, Health Resource and Service Administration, 16 awards. So you can see that a lot of these are relatively small. Some are larger than others. But they, as important as they are, they restrict how we can do a lot of our activities and decrease our flexibility. And I particularly want to make the case that there are some places where we have very limited or no state funding into some things that are really important. Emergency preparedness. All of our emergency preparedness comes from the federal government. Without that, we would not have the responses that we can make to floods and to the Zika virus and you know, various kinds of weather-related problems. Community and family health and infectious disease. All of our vaccine work is federally funded, and over 75% of that budget comes from the feds. And so if that is decreased or eliminated, we don't have any resources to back up some of the things that are really crucial to really make a difference in our state. So with that, I'm now going to, that's a sort of general overview of our state health department, and I will be asking some of my assistant commissioners to come up and do some presentations related to their specific areas, but I'd like to see first if there are any questions of me before I bring up some of our assistant commissioners.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation, Commissioner, and thanks for your efforts on protecting the health and welfare of the citizens of the state of Minnesota. You know, on my handout here, it's on page 2, I do have the life expectancy versus health expenditures graph.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the beginning?
Yes.
You know, in the private sector, I'm a small business owner. I'm a born optimist. But when it comes to government, I become a skeptical pessimist. Okay? And I've read, you know, I try to read a lot of articles on health care. And one of the things I've read about these international comparisons is that some of the data is flawed in terms of comparing different countries' life expectancy versus health expenditures. And several things that just came to mind during your presentation. We're one of the few countries that spend a tremendous amount on keeping preborn children alive compared to other countries that don't take that initiative. Also, how you count the data in coming up with this graph, according to the articles I've read, can vary greatly between the different countries versus the U.S., and especially how many of the citizens from foreign countries fly into the United States to get their treatment and then are counted in life expectancy in the foreign country to make it look better. And finally, we are the hub of innovation, both in terms of medical device, medical treatments, also prescription drugs. And we tend to bear the cost of that. And according to my medical device engineer, we bear an exponential cost because we have a Food and Drug Administration that, according to my medical device engineer friend, that is a fossilized dinosaur in its operations. I won't get into the tort law and the number of lawyers we have here compared to other countries that affect health care. But the point is, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I do think you have to take some of this information with a certain level of skepticism, because I'm not quite sure that all the data is used similarly to come up with these graphs. Any thoughts on that, Commissioner Etcher?
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I share your concerns about data. I mean, we always have to be data skeptics. We always have to ask questions about where the data come from, and we certainly pride ourselves in really looking at where the data come from, and we try to do sources. The data here are from the National Center for Health Statistics and from the World Bank and from the World Health Organization. So that doesn't mean the data are perfect, but they're certainly there. So we pay attention to the data, and we try to get as good a data as possible. And I can't disagree that healthcare is really, really important. As I mentioned in my testimony, we need a good healthcare system. But we also need to focus on some of the other factors that really impact health. And looking at how we spend our dollars, this is a policy issue. How should we balance our investment in medical care and public health and human services? And we can show data about the impact, and you'll see some of the things that we do that really are not related to services, that are really related to changing the conditions and the impact that they have on health. And those are the conversations that we should have about how do we make investments that actually make a difference in the health of folks in our communities.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up. Are there any initiatives that you have promoted or are promoting this session that will bring efficiency and effectiveness to your department and help bring the cost down and yet still meet the goals of protecting the health and welfare of the citizens of the state of Minnesota?
Commissioner Ellinger.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, we have a quality improvement council at the department, and we are constantly looking at ways to improve what we do. We are one of the few agencies that have received multiple awards for improved efficiency and effectiveness of services. This is an ongoing activity that we do to try to make sure. We know that, our budget has not risen with inflation. So we've had to become more efficient. We've had to do that for many, many years. So we've looked for efficiencies. At some point, you have to think about how much more can you do with the dollars that you've got.
Thank you, Commissioner. And for folks who might be watching, we are televised today. The handouts that the commissioner is referring to are available on the committee website if people want to look at those. Next question is from Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there something that all those other countries have in common that we don't have?
Commissioner Linger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Considine, there are a lot of things that they don't have. One, they have universal access to health care. That's one of the factors. They focus a lot. One of the issues that we've been focusing on that we know and will be part of our discussion is home visiting, public health home visiting. Many of these have universal home visiting for all pregnant women and newborns. We only do home visiting for a select group of folks, and that's one of those evidence-based practices that shows that it can really impact the health of the baby, can impact the health of the mother, it can impact high school graduation rates, and it can help impact employment. So there are many other factors like that in other countries where they do some of the things that have been evidence-based that we don't do at the same scale that others do.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On slide number 8, where you've got the expanding the understanding of what creates health, the two biggest factors have to do with health behaviors and then social and economic factors. Would it be a fair statement to say that the social and economic factors are what drive healthy behaviors?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lunin, you must have heard some of my presentations out in the community because I make that point a lot. I think most of the behaviors are actually impacted by the living conditions in which people have. If you don't have access to healthy food, if you don't have access to a safe community, if you don't have access to good transportation, it is really difficult for you to make healthy choices. So we often use the mantra making the healthy choice the easy choice. First of all, we need to make the healthy choice a possible choice. And for some folks, the healthy choice is not a possible choice. So what we're doing in terms of a lot of our work with trying to, you know, deal with food in local communities, both urban and rural, to have access to healthy food, making sure that children have access to safe play spaces and active transportation, those and safe housing. Those are the things that we do to make sure that people have the opportunity to make healthy choices. I always think I believe that we need to hold people responsible for their choices, but we as me, certainly as a public official, I want to make sure that we do our job to make sure that they have the opportunity to make that choice.
All right. Don't see any other questions. Commissioner Ellinger, would you like to continue with the presentation with one of your assistant commissioners?
Yes. Let me first introduce the team that's with me. So not all will be coming up here, but I have Deputy Commissioner Dan Pollack is with me. And then we have the assistant commissioners in our bureaus, Paul Allwood, Gene Ayers, Gil Acevedo, and Lee Ho. We have Melissa Finnegan, who's our government relations director. We have our legislative liaisons, Chelsea Magadance and Amira Adawi. And our chief financial officer, Abby Mosher, and our budget director, Brian Awesome. So they're the team that can answer a lot of the questions if you get too specific beyond my level of knowledge at this point in time. But now I'm going to bring Paul Allwood up, who is one of the assistant commissioners, to really talk about the work that's done in his area and the budget that goes along with that.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Allwood. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Paul Allwood. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Health Protection Bureau, and that bureau consists of the divisions of Environmental Health, Infectious Disease Epidemiology, and our Public Health Laboratory. So I'll be, trying to tell you a little bit about the work that happens in the Health Protection Bureau. We're going to try to do this in stories, so if you don't mind. And I'll be sharing two stories and then also talking about some of the programs and budgets within the health protection area, and then I'll be passing it on to my colleagues to tell the rest of the story. So the first story I'll tell is one about protecting residents from chemicals in water. For many years, the 3M company disposed of products containing perfluorochemicals, or PFCs, in a landfill and three dump sites in Washington County. The chemicals were used to make products that were resistant to heat and oil and stains and grease and water. However, eventually these chemicals ended up in groundwater. And back in 2003, MDH discovered that many private wells in the area had these PFCs in them. And furthermore, that the levels of PFCs found in these drinking water sources were high enough to be a health concern. In response to this, MDH worked with the cities in the area to connect the affected residents to city systems where that was available. And if that was not, then we would provide treatment systems, working in collaboration with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And in particular, we provided carbon filters and or bottled water to those residents. By 2006, our hundreds of affected residents were on treated water or bottled water supplies. In May of 2016, we found out that the EPA was lowering its health advisory levels for these PFCs. And whereas in Minnesota we had a level of 300 parts per million for PFCs in drinking water, for certain PFCs, the EPA was going to lower that level to 70 parts per million. I'm sorry, 7 parts per trillion, parts per trillion. So this raised the concern that many of the households that we had, you know, properly remediated were now going to have a new concern for drinking water safety. And so through outreach to many households in the area, we were able to provide them with additional treatment as necessary and or put them on bottled water supplies, working in collaboration with our partners at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So for residents in that part of the state, we were pleased to say that based on our initial findings of high levels of PFCs in drinking water in the area, by 2006, we saw that the levels in people's blood, you know, through our biomonitoring efforts were steadily decreasing. However, as of 2014, we know that those levels are still uncomfortably high, and we are continuing to conduct testing. In 2016, we tested about 250 wells and sent additional advisory letters to 157 families whose PFC levels in their wells were above what was advisable by the EPA. And we've also provided bottled water to families in the area whose wells had PFC levels that were above the advisory threshold. We're continuing to do this work, and we're paying close attention to what's at developments at the federal level, and also through our own scientific review of these chemicals, to make sure that we continue to protect our citizens from these harmful chemicals. So, with that, I'm going to provide a little bit of information about the Environmental Health Division. It's the largest division in the Health Protection Bureau, and the responsibilities of the Environmental Health Division include testing drinking water. We test about 7,000 public water supplies each year. We also ensure that food, drinking water, lodging conditions, and swimming pools in about 23,000 establishments statewide are safe. We test private wells and issue advisories where contamination has been discovered that poses a risk to human health. And then we also provide education and assistance with a variety of environmental pollutants, including things like asbestos, lead, indoor, we work in indoor arenas, we enforce the Minnesota Clean Indoor Air Act, we provide guidance with radon, and also we help to promote indoor environmental quality in schools. The division has a base budget of $78 million, and as you can see from the pie chart, Most of that, about 62%, comes from fees. There's a significant amount that comes from the federal government, about 24%. General fund provides 8%, and there's a other category that's about 6%. I was just going to mention that the division has about 286 staff in 2016, and the budget, the base budget, doesn't include the Clean Water Fund.
Thank you, Commissioner Allwood. We do have a question from Representative Halverson. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, with the recent incident that happened in Blaine, is that an example of something that the state gets involved in terms of testing when the water is potable again? And what role did you play in that?
Commissioner Allwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, thanks. That's a great question. Yeah, we do put out advisories, and we did in that situation in Blaine that you described. Initially, when we discovered that there was a fault that compromised water quality, and once we conducted additional testing and was confident that the water supply was safe, we lifted the advisory and then informed people that it was safe to go back to using the water.
Thank you. Please continue.
So the other story that I'll tell has to do with this wonderful mosquito, the Aedes aegypti mosquito. Many people refer to this mosquito as the rat of mosquitoes because it's so closely adapted to humans and has been a real bane to our existence for a long time. But you know, as the commissioner mentioned, you know, just over a year ago, Zika was essentially unheard of in this part of the world. And then in 2016, we began to hear about cases of you know, fairly severe health problems related to the Zika virus occurring in Central America, in South America, and the Caribbean. People in Minnesota obviously began to become worried, as particularly those people who travel to parts of the world where the Zika virus was circulating. The department responded, you know, quickly and I think appropriately, in providing key information to healthcare providers and the public, including people who were most at risk, so people could protect themselves when they were traveling. We also developed a statewide Zika response plan, and our infectious disease division and the public health lab worked together with the CDC to establish a monitoring program here in Minnesota that allowed us to more quickly provide testing to citizens of the state and provide information to individuals who needed to be tested about their status. We also worked with our national partners, including the Association of State and Territorial Health Officers, to develop a national response plan. And we, you know, did that in anticipation of what has become a reality, the fact that Zika would be an issue in the southern parts of the United States, such as in the state of Florida and in the state of Texas. So by the end of 2016, our efforts at MDH had allowed us to respond to something like 1,200 calls and questions from health providers and the public. We conducted almost 900 lab tests and confirmed almost 60 cases of Zika. The threat continues, but we are prepared in Minnesota. We have I think, created the capacity here to respond quickly and appropriately, and we will continue to do that to the best of our ability with the resources that are available. And so a little bit about the infectious disease division, the programs in the division, and the work that's done in that division. The division investigated 200 intestinal disease outbreaks in 2015 and played a key role in solving numerous multi-state foodborne illness outbreaks. Infectious disease also responded to, you know, as I mentioned earlier, 1,200 calls from healthcare providers and the public about Zika, and that led to our receiving and testing about 900 specimens. We investigated 5,500 tick-borne disease in 2015, and provided vaccines to one out of every three children in Minnesota. We managed treatments for 151 tuberculosis cases and evaluated 685 new case contacts in 2013. Finally, we coordinated health screenings for about 2,000 newly arrived refugees in 2015. The Infectious Disease Division has a base budget of $65 million, and as you can see, 80%, which is a huge proportion, is federal. The general fund provides 12% of the budget, and there are other sources that provide 8%. The division in 2016 has a staffing cadre of 175. And the final division in health protection is the public health laboratory. Some of the work that goes on in public health lab include performing 139,000 analyses on more than 41,000 samples to detect environmental contaminants such as pharmaceuticals, hazardous chemicals, and radioactive substances. In 2016, the lab performed 128,750 tests on 43,950 samples for viruses and other germs such as Salmonella, Ebola, and Zika. The lab also screened 68,000 newborn babies for more than 50 rare disorders, including hearing loss and congenital heart disease. The lab has also been recognized and designated as a genome tracker site by the FDA. This happened in 2013. The lab has been selected as an Ebola testing site for the CDC and conducts tests for people within the state of Minnesota, but also does some tests for some for other states that hasn't yet created capacity. And then in 2016, the lab had the fairly significant honor of being named one of the reference labs for the Antimicrobial Resistance Laboratory Network. The lab has a budget of $53 million. Federal funds provide 40% of that, fees 35%, other 16%. The lab has a staff of 131 persons. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just wondering, back to the environmental health area, how does the work of that division interact with MPCA? I've always been curious about that, like in terms of drinking water, et cetera.
Commissioner Allwood.
Right. So essentially, the Department of Health has primacy for drinking water, and we are the primacy agency for the Safe Drinking Water Act, and the PCA has primacy for other waters, wastewaters and other waters, and so they're enforcing the relevant federal laws that govern those other waters. We partner very closely in a number of things. Obviously, what goes into the drinking water system tends to get into the wastewater system and vice versa, unfortunately. And so part of what we try to do is to make sure that we are kind of seamless in thinking about water as a sort of a continuous process. And we function together on an environmental sub-cabinet, and we're collaborating very actively on a wide range of projects.
Thank you. And for members who want to follow along in the budget books that are in your packets, they were going section by section within that. So if you want to look at that, and it will be coming out in the governor's budget on January 24th. But those are the specific pieces for environmental health, and all the other portions are within those books as well. I just had a question for Commissioner Allwood, just with specific respect to Zika. With the warnings that were out in the last year about travel, could you just talk a little bit about where that is in the United States? I know a lot of people travel to Florida to go to Disneyland and to go to Miami, where they did have instances of that. How far north did that go? And does the Minnesota Department of Health have specific warnings for Minnesotans traveling to, whether they go to Florida or other areas that are affected, of what they might be looking out for pregnant women or others? And just what are we saying to Minnesotans about that?
So thank you, Mr. Chair. We have seen cases of Zika in the state of Florida and in the state of Texas. The Minnesota Department of Health is following CDC guidelines regarding travel as a traveler's information to protect travelers from risk of Zika. There are currently no CDC advisories regarding travel to any part of the continental United States. However, in general, we say to travelers who are going to areas where the vector of the Aedes aegypti mosquito is known to be locally established, such as the southern United States, to take appropriate precautions in minimizing your exposure to mosquito bites, such as using appropriate mosquito repellents and avoiding areas or activities that would expose you to additional mosquito contact.
Thank you. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that same graph, I see there's a couple of statistics around tick-borne illnesses and diseases. Crow Wing County is in one of those hot zones where there's a lot of difficulty around that. Sometimes I've heard some folks mention CDC guidelines and recommendations in terms of treatments and diagnosis, and just want to confirm, how often is that information updated or those protocols updated to your knowledge?
Commissioner Allwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntsman, that's a really good question. The CDC has been very vigilant in providing information to the states about various infectious diseases. Can't specifically speak to how frequently they update their guidance on something like tick-borne infections. However, I can say that we have a program within our state health department that pays very close attention to what comes out of the CDC, but also what we learn here from our surveillance of tick-borne diseases. And, working with the CDC and our own epidemiological investigations, we've tried to be very current and relevant with the guidance that we provide around tick-borne and other types of arthropod-borne diseases.
Thank you. All right. Commissioner Ellinger?
No more questions. I'd like to invite Assistant Commissioner Gil Acevedo to...
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Acevedo. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gil Acevedo, Assistant Commissioner for the Health Systems Bureau. The Health Systems Bureau consists of health regulations, health policy, and Office of Medical Cannabis. And like Commissioner Allwood, I will go through and just kind of talk a little bit in the storytelling spirit and just kind of highlight some key areas within our various divisions and then kind of break into a little bit more detail into each area within our division. So I like to start with health policy. Health policy division spends time looking at research and also looking at critical policy topics that would be helpful to state policymakers and private sector leaders. And this one area that I'd like to talk about is the healthcare spending and insurance coverage and identifying concerns of spending with chronic disease. The health policy division in 2016 for the first time, placed a dollar figure on the state's chronic disease spending using data gathered from the Minnesota payers, payer all payers claims, all payers claims data, also known as APCD. During the research, we looked at, we learned that in 2012, Minnesota spending a bill for chronic disease was approximately $22.7 billion. That meant that care for patients with at least one chronic disease accounted for 83% of the medical care spending in the state in 2012. As you know, health care continues to increase and rise and becomes unsustainable. And so doing the work that health policy does in doing research, identifying different types of health conditions and ways to identify costs so that policymakers like yourself can make decisions based on the facts or the information that was provided. When this information, this report came out, the Isanti County Commissioner, Susan Morris, made a statement that seeing these costs made her reflect on a huge incentive, the huge incentive we all have to live healthier lives. It also made me optimistic that our county can use this data to focus our attention on the greatest health needs and drill down to figure out what's driving cost differences and help our residents be better consumers for health care. So within the health policy division, as you can see, we have the first area I'd like to talk about is the Office of Vital Records. We oversee the issuance of more than 600,000 birth and death certificates each year in collaboration with local registrars. The healthcare homes area, we have certified a little over 370 primary care clinics as healthcare homes, providing high-quality coordinated care to 3.7 million Minnesotans, saving more than $1 billion over 5 years. Health economics program does a number of the studies that I just discussed earlier as an example, and they provide health economic data and analysis through a number of reports and issue briefs, and has done 19 presentation and 30 media request events, over 100 requests for public data in 2016 alone. In the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, we issue a little over 800 grants, totaling nearly $78 million to health care, social services, and local public health organizations. That was also in 2016. We also do a number of work with quality. So we monitor health care quality and safety through statewide reporting and measurement system, also known as SQRMS. And we also work with statewide trauma system and adverse health events system. This is where adverse events are reported back to the Department of Health as they occur within hospitals. The base budget for the health policy is $236 million with an FTE count of 114. And you can see the breakdown of the budget itself.
The Office Commissioner, I had just a question about that graph.
Sure.
The Healthcare Access Fund portion of your budget, is that directed towards individual policies or FTEs, or how do you know off the top of your head where that goes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a variety of programs. It also includes a number of staff in those programs that that funds, the Healthcare Access Fund. The Office of Medical Cannabis has a number of conditions that we work with as passed in legislation. Most recently, post-traumatic stress disorder was added as a serious condition, as a condition for medical cannabis. As you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, is a serious condition and at times is could be life-altering psychological conditions associated with extreme traumatic experience such as combat or sexual assault. About 8% of Americans suffer from PTSD. Despite its prevalence, there's relatively few good treatment alternatives. One of the alternatives that has been discussed is the use of medical cannabis, and has actually been discussed as to be able to offer some potential value as a treatment option. We just recently went through a petition process where citizens can submit conditions to the department to be considered to be added to the list of conditions for medical cannabis. That process goes pretty much through the summer, where we actually receive the conditions pretty well detailed, sent out to the department. We have a citizens panel that will help review the conditions. We go through a summary of the conditions, and I'll post those on our website as well. And once all of this is conducted, we also do public testimony and public feedback from the Minnesotans. And it's provided to the commissioner, at which time the commissioner will need to make a decision on whether adding a condition or not, and that condition, whether it's added, is in December when it's actually done. This year, we went through the process for, we had about 10 conditions, and the commissioner added PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, as a new condition along with methods, new methods to be added, such as ointment or creams as a method to use, the delivery method for medical cannabis. We received a little over 50 public comments from citizens that are in the review panel for research summaries, and then the commissioner reviewed all of those, and as I said, he presented, he made that decision. The Office of Medical Cannabis currently has approved enrollment of a little over 5,000 patients. 4,000 of those are currently active, and we have 455 caregivers in the registry. That's as of January 6, 2017. We have a little over 700, actually almost 800, 792 healthcare practitioners to certify patients. And our work in the Office of Medical Cannabis is to oversee the work of the two manufacturers and eight cannabis patient centers, which received, as an example, in September, over 2,000 patient visits at their patient centers. We responded when the program first started. In the first year, we responded to a little over 26,000 calls at our call center. And as part of the law that for medical cannabis, the commissioner had to entertain first intractable pain before adding any other conditions. And in 2016, the commissioner added intractable pain as well. The base budget for medical cannabis is $2.8 million, and our FTE count is 13. Health regulations is an area where we regulate, we license, and we also regulate facilities such as nursing homes and hospitals, funeral homes, and things of that nature. So Minnesota works to protect approximately 126,000 vulnerable adults receiving care in 2,600 facilities or in communities around the state. Between 2010 and 2014, the Office of Medical Cannabis saw more than 500% increase in the number of maltreatment allegations that were filed to them. The total jumped from 3,600 in 2010 to about 20,000 just 4 years later. By 2016, the Office of Health Facilities Complaint received 24,210 allegations of maltreatment. This increase doubled the average caseload for an investigator. The average caseload for an investigator was 15. It doubled to about 30 open cases at any given time. This increase was due to several factors, things such as the population, older population as people age, in particular in greater Minnesota, which requires more services, improved reporting by care providers, and also the potential for a workforce shortage. We responded to the challenge in a number of ways. In 2015, Minnesota overhauled the health care regulation, home care regulation, excuse me, included more frequent inspections and surveys. In that year, Minnesota also moved the centralized reporting system known as the Common Entry Point, or also known as the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center. This approach provides one clear standard point of contact for all facilities and individuals. Prior to that, there were more than 120 different telephone numbers to call in a complaint. And there was a lot of confusion as to, do I call law enforcement? Do I call the county? Do I call DHS? Who should I call? And so now there's a common entry point where there's one call, one number. In addition, we know that families feel frustrated that they do not have information and clear process. MDH has been streamlining its own intake process and management process. So what we've done is with our intake process, we've recently completed a Kaizen event identifying ways to improve our process and ensure that we return information as far as letting family members know whether we have picked up the case and what are we doing with that particular case or complaint. We've done a number of other things at NDH. We know that we make sure that we contact and interview every family member who submit a complaint, as I mentioned. We're also hiring temporary employees to help alleviate the excess workload existing for investigations. The investigation comes in through an intake process, gets triaged, gets assigned to an investigator, and through that whole process, there's a number of documentation that needs to occur with it. And then finally, we developed technology and solutions to improve our computer tracking system to better manage the caseloads and keep families better informed. Health Regulations has licensing and certification that monitors 4,200 health facilities and provides for safety and quality. This is licensing and certification and Office of Health Facilities Complaint. The Health Occupations Program reviews qualifications and regulates more than 6,700 allied health practitioners. The Managed Care System monitors 9 health maintenance organizations and 3 county-based purchasing organizations that provide health care to 1.1 million Minnesotans. The Managed Care Section also does the work on network adequacy when reviewing plans, networks, and their networks as they get submitted. I apologize. Mortuary Science area inspects 560 funeral establishments and licensed approximately 1,300 morticians. They also monitor crematories along with funeral homes. The case mix area reviews more than 200,000 federal nursing home resident assessments to ensure accurate billing of services. This is done through the assessments that are done in nursing homes before they bill for Medicare and Medicaid services. And the nurse aid registry, along with our spoken language interpreter, health interpreter program, we register more than 3,400 spoken language interpreters through a roster that we maintain, and more than 60,000 nursing assistants through our registry. base budget for the health regulations is 40.
Excuse me, Commissioner, I interrupt you just for a second. Representative Lunan has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These monitoring reports, are they on your website? Are they available to the public, the results?
Commissioner Acevedo.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it depends. It depends. Let me clarify that, if you don't mind. So as we go through and we conclude investigations, we place those on our website, although when they're open, they're considered private because there's an active investigation. We don't have those on our website.
So we can view the completed ones.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner Acevedo. You said there was a 500% increase in complaints, which is pretty shocking. We know there's a workforce shortage and short staff sometimes, even in spite of the best efforts of people sometimes. But can you tell us what was the response in terms of the growth rate in substantiated complaints? So you got a lot more complaints, and are we starting to see also more a growth rate in those that are substantiated and found to be valid or concerning?
Commissioner Acevedo.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the number of complaints are divided into facility self-report complaints. They can also be mandated reporter complaints, and there can also be family members or individual complaints that are submitted. The number of facility self-report complaints oftentimes are resolved very quickly because, as an example, under the Vulnerable Adult Act and federal regulations, if an incident occurs, the facility is supposed to report immediately within 24 hours. So they send in a report to our intake, and within a few days, they may resolve it. As an example would be, someone claims that they had $200 that was stolen from them. Once the facility within the first 24 hours couldn't resolve that, so they sent in a complaint to us. And we then go through and put it in intake, but then the facility will do their own investigation and find that potentially a family member came and picked up the laundry, took it home, and found that there was $200 in the individual's pocket. They'll call us back up, and we resolve it at that point. The other area that we have is there are a number of complaints that actual harm do not occur or the potential for actual harm, and we do our investigation right at the desk. We don't send somebody out. So if there is no actual harm because of the volume that we have, we may not necessarily investigate that case immediately. But then what we do is we talk to the licensing and certification area, and when they go out to do their normal survey, they add that as part of their survey or inspection to verify what happened in that case. We are seeing a number of substantiated cases, and what we're seeing is an uptick in cases with home care, where we're starting to get more. And what's happening there is that we are going out more frequently because of the new law that passed. We're actually providing more oversight of the home care area. So because of that, we're either finding it on site or they're reporting it to us.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen has a question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, on your cannabis slide, the Commissioner, you talked about it, expanding the conditions that it can be used for. What do you use a certain medical criteria? How do you come with the conclusion that this particular condition, we should expand the use of cannabis for that?
Commissioner Ellinger.
I'll take that one since I had to make that decision, Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen. As Assistant Commissioner Acevedo mentioned, we had a whole process of reviewing the citizens panel, which has experts in pain and chronic disease, look at it and look at the science and public comment and talk about the pros and cons. We then have staff do a literature review about all of the studies that have been done related to the medical treatment of, in this case, PTSD, looked at conditions related to both benefits and harm. And then I talked with experts around the country and with colleagues in other states who have medical cannabis programs to decide if the benefits outweigh the risks in terms of cannabis. Have to admit, you know, talking about data, there, because of the constraints that cannabis has had at the federal level, there aren't as many studies as we would like as a healthcare provider. But given that limitation, we looked at all of the published studies that were out there, both clinical trials and other reviews, to make that determination based on the best science that we could have at the time.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your response, Commissioner. The other question, and this is just to refresh my memory, I think in our law that the most effective ways, I was on some of the committees when the bill passed through initially, some of the most effective ways to receive the benefit of cannabis is vaporizing and the oils, if I remember right. That's just off the top of my head. But not smoking. In fact, smoking was one of the least effective ways. Do we allow the smoking of cannabis for medical treatment in the state of Minnesota? I don't believe we do.
Commissioner Ellinger.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, we do not allow use of leaf cannabis, either smoking or in vaporizing. We can only use oils and pills and now lotion.
Thank you.
Commissioner Acevedo.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to just point out that the base budget for health regulation is $49 million with an FTE count of 218. And also wanted to identify that although we put a number of measures into Office of Health Facilities complaint, we continue to look at ways to be more efficient with the work that's coming in. We also feel that the population, as it continues to age, we expect that demand will continue to increase and the department will need to hire more investigators in the future to manage the demand as it comes in. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, and I will be ready to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Murphy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for one of the two commissioners, I'm wondering if you have any information to share with the committee about the use of opioids in the state of Minnesota. We know we have a problem with that. And its relationship with or data about medical cannabis as a potential relief mechanism in the use of opioids.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would like to postpone that question because we are going to be talking a little bit about opioids with Assistant Commissioner Gene Ayers, so maybe we could tee it up at that point in time if that's okay.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'd like to introduce Assistant Commissioner Gene Ayers.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. I am Assistant Commissioner Gene Ayers. I oversee the Health Improvement Bureau, which includes the Office of Statewide Health Improvement, Health Promotion, Chronic Disease, and the Community Family Health Units. I also serve as the chief lead on health equity as the chief health equity strategist. I'm going to use the time that I have to highlight a few issues that are in the news. I will have some bullet points like my predecessors that to highlight some of the scale and scope and breadth of the program. But the main takeaway that I'd like to leave you with about the Health Improvement Bureau is that this part of the agency, and actually the agency as a whole, but this part of the agency works on health threats and issues that have very deep roots and are of interconnected risk factors. So they we look at how we can take a systems approach to prevention, and that systems approach spans what we would call community-based, population-based preventive strategies, and those are often focused on changing policy and systems and the environment, all the way to what we would describe as individual preventive strategies that focus on early detection of disease at an individual level and or through the healthcare system and to decrease disability and death. So I love that. It's the whole span of prevention. The first story that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about is diabetes. About in 2014, 340,000 people in the state of Minnesota reported that they had type 1 or type 2 diabetes. Our estimate of what that costs the state is about $2.3 billion a year. So diabetes is a pretty significant problem in at a family level, at an employer level, and in the healthcare system. So the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division is a strong supporter of what we call of a program called the Diabetes Prevention Program. This is an evidence-based approach that works with people who are at high risk of developing diabetes, so they aren't in that 340,000 yet. And it is a program to help people make individual lifestyle changes to prevent the onset of diabetes. We partner with the Department of Human Services, healthcare systems, community groups, local public health to provide this program to do the training. And one example would be, for example, Marvin Windows enrolled more than 500 employees in the program, and those people who were enrolled in the program lost more than 5% of weight over just that 16-week program. So overall, the outcome, we get feedback from the Centers for Disease Control. They reported to us that in June of 2016, 3,111 Minnesotans who had participated in the program had lost an average of 5% of their body weight after 1 year, so post the program. So this is the kind of program that the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division is engaged in. A second example that comes out of the work in that division is the work around opioids. I know it's in the news, and I'm sure you've heard from your constituents and in the papers about the growing epidemic of opioid use. In Minnesota, we have seen the same things that are happening in the nationally. This isn't a problem confined to urban centers. It affects communities large and small across the state and the nation. And the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease, they have been the leads in terms of really looking at the data and figuring out what's going on. They provide vital information to policymakers, the media, community leaders about the scope of the problem. In 2016, we found that drug overdose deaths, including those of unintentional deaths and suicide, had jumped 11% in the state just between 2014 and 2015, and that we are now at four times higher than the year 2000 when we had 129 drug overdoses. Drug overdose deaths. The outcome then of the work, so the part of the work of the division is to basically be the ones who look at, analyze, and look for the root causes, but also look at the actual data. Tracking of the data in this case has led to work on many fronts, including moving upstream to begin to decrease the excessive prescribing of opioid medications, getting life-saving medications such as naloxone into the communities to treat overdoses, doing education with pharmacists and healthcare providers and family members, and improving access for people who have developed addictions. So this brings me to the slide. So this is just a quick summary. I try to just put into these slides some numbers to show you the scope and the breadth of the programs. This is a summary. When you look at the budget here, this particular division is very successful at getting federal grants. These are not like easy to get grants. We have to be competitive to get these grants. So 57% of the funding for the division comes from the federal funds, 38% from the general fund, and overall there's 114 people in this division. One of the things that is a big piece that we do is work around cancer and cancer surveillance or registry and system, as well as cancer screening. So the first point here is that we've worked with clinics and payers and community-based organizations to screen 10,500 low-income women for breast and cervical cancer. That's just in a year, and that's people who wouldn't have gotten that kind of screening. Again, back to the opioid epidemic, we've administered the naloxone program that was supported by legislature last year, and through the regional EMS directors, and work with partners to influence the prescribing practices and look for prevention initiatives. Trained 130 people to be diabetes prevention program lifestyle coaches, and to provide classes to people at risk of developing diabetes. And another initiative from the legislature has been the Safe Harbors Program. And the Safe Harbors Program, we have worked with over 600 at-risk or exploited youth through that program since we've gotten started. And another area, which is often in the news, is working with campuses around sexual assault and helping to train and support campus staff across the state around and advocates on how to prevent and respond to sexual violence, and also ways to investigate and adjudicate reports. I'm talking about these deep-rooted problems that continue to create challenges for us. I want to talk a little bit about obesity, and where does it really begin, and how do we begin to impact obesity beginning at the very beginning of this child's life? In Minnesota, we have recognized that obesity affects, we had talked about diabetes, but also heart disease, cancer, musculoskeletal disability, and there's just like a lot of things that end up coming together. The annual cost is estimated in Minnesota to be $2.8 billion for obesity. The risk factors for adult obesity often begin in childhood. And we have some data to show that obese children who become obese adults face more severe health consequences. And it's roughly about $19,000 more for direct medical costs over the course of their life compared to children who are at normal weight when you get to adulthood. So one of the responses is to how do you begin to make change around this? Our Women, Infants, and Children program that you heard, the WIC program, is one area, and that program has worked with promoting healthy eating and food choices and healthy food packages by working with and breastfeeding, and then working with local partners and providers of the food and the parents, and has basically been able to reach. We have a large number of people who participate in that program. And the outcome of the intentional efforts around this has been pretty positive. We were excited to see that the Centers for Disease Control did a study looking at childhood obesity in the country and reported that Minnesota's obesity rate among children between 2 and 4 from low-income families who participate in the WIC program had decreased from 12.7% in 2010 to 12.3% in 2014. Doesn't sound like a huge number, but it's actually pretty significant, and it stands out in the country in terms of something that Minnesota is doing differently. And basically, we are eighth lowest in the nation for that. And so we've turned the curve in that area. And this is, again, around making these kinds of policy system changes that also engage, I think, to the earlier question, how do you support the parent in the choices and the opportunities? So that to look at the budget, this is a fairly large budget for us, the community family health budget, but that is where the WIC funds flow through. There are 107 people working in this area, and the WIC program reaches about 193,000 people, women and young children, annually. prenatal, parenting, child safety, and other kinds of support for women. Those initiatives reach 10,000 women. Family planning counseling, more than 48,000 high-risk individuals. We do evidence-based home visiting to improve maternal child health outcomes. For 3,500 families, the commissioner mentioned this as an evidence-based strategy that is more pervasive than other parts of the world. But we reached 3,500 families. Teen pregnancy prevention efforts for 28,000 teens. We connect 31,000 children with special health needs. You probably have heard people speak about the newborn screening effort when we find children who are hard of hearing, deaf, have metabolic issues. We're following 31,000 children and connecting them to supports and services, again, through local partnerships. We provide, this division works to provide commodity foods for over 15,000 low-income seniors. That mostly goes out to food shelves and contracting for seniors who are having difficulty struggling to get food on the table and not have to choose between medicine and food. And so that's that division. And then
I'm going to just interrupt you quickly. Yeah. Representative Liebling has a question.
Okay.
And I see you have several slides left, and we've got want to wrap up fairly quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Ayer, I'll be really quick. I'm just I noticed you had this in your slide 29. You had this the part about the opioid epidemic, and I was looking to try to find where that is in the budget. I didn't see it mentioned in the – do you know that? Or maybe you could get it to me later. And in particular also, I have a do you know right now where that is?
Which –
The opioid activities that you do, are they? Can we find them in the budget document?
We'll get, Mr. Chair, we can get you some specifics. We have a very limited state investment for the naloxone, and then I believe that the work is being funded through federal grant.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, and Ms. Ayers, the other piece of my question, I'm just curious that you didn't mention anything about the PMP, this prescription monitoring program, and I'm just wondering, is that funded out of health at all, or is that, or can you just tell me, is it funded through the Board of Pharmacy?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lieber, we work with the Board of Pharmacy on the prescription drug monitoring program, but the funding goes to the Board of Pharmacy.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and to the commissioners. Again, to the question about that intersection between opioid use and addiction and medical cannabis, when I think about chronic pain, when I think about cancer, when I think about PTSD and the ability or the use of opioids and potential addiction and medical cannabis, I'm wondering if you have information that you can share with us about the approach of medical cannabis in a way to attack opioid addiction.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's one of the issues that we're really looking at in terms of opioid use is a huge problem. We are working collectively with the Department of Human Services and law enforcement and courts in terms of how to deal with that. We're also looking at what data we can collect to see if the medical cannabis actually would reduce opioids. That has been one of the questions that should have been answered in the past but hasn't because of some of the restrictions on research. Some states or some studies have shown that there is a reduction in opioid use by people who use cannabis, but the data are not strong enough yet to really make a strong statement.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then as I understand it, in the 21st Century Cures Act, there are grants dealing with opioids and opioid addiction. Is the Department of Health looking into applying for those grants?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe the Department of Human Services is applying for the Cures Act, if I understand correctly. We get $300,000 for the prescription drug monitoring from CDC to help us with that. So state dollars don't go there from us. It's the CDC dollars. And I'm not sure about the Cures Act. I know we're looking at that. That has just come out, so I'm not sure where we are with that.
Thanks. Commissioners.
So the final story I wanted to share is really, again, it's about beginning healthy habits early in life, and brings me to the understanding. We know that diet and physical activity are key determinants for health for people of all ages, and the experiences that begin in early life pay dividends throughout the lifespan. Examples include eating more fruits and vegetables as a child, more physical activity, but we know it's not easy to necessarily make those things happen. So in 2008, the legislature and policymakers responded to the skyrocketing healthcare costs by instituting or beginning a program called the Statewide Health Improvement Partnership. Then that investment had sparked thousands of projects across the state and efforts that are led by local teams to change policies and systems and create healthy environments. So one example of that is that SHIP grantees offer and provide technical support to child care providers across the state, encouraging them to offer fruits and vegetables, increase the support for breastfeeding mothers, and increase physical activity in the child care. We've reached, I think, something like 768 child care provider sites and, thousands of children through that initiative. And the analysis, we recently completed the analysis, and it showed that 13% there was a 13% increase in child care providers offering fruits and vegetables to kids at least twice a day. There was a 21% increase to 90 minutes a day of physical activity. And also we've seen that there are an increase in the numbers of providers who've actually written this out as policies in their organizations and centers, and we see that there's a direct link to making a written policy and a commitment to that and actually doing it. So that brings me to my final slide, which is that just a summary then of the work of the Office of Statewide Health Improvement. Through that initiative, it's funded the most of it is coming from the Healthcare Access Fund and then some federal grants as well as some tobacco-free communities grant funding. And so $17 million goes out to cities, counties, and tribes across the state to expand the opportunities. And, again, the language that we usually use is active living, healthy eating, tobacco-free living. Those are the areas of focus. And then another $3.2 million for tobacco, reducing tobacco use. Through those initiatives, we partner with 2,000-some partner sites and 651 schools, and those schools are reaching 373,000-some students. We have 82 communities working on their comp plans to improve walkability, impacting over 2 million people. 473 employers have been instituting and advancing workplace initiatives, reaching 148,000 employees, and back to that 768 child care settings, reaching over 9,000 students. So I just wanted to put some of those numbers to give you an idea of the scope and scale. This work is really done at a local level through community leadership teams. So I'll take questions and make sure that we don't run out of time.
Thanks, Assistant Commissioner Ayers. I just had one question. You talked about the benefits of exercise and food for young kids long term. Have you studied or do you know of studies in Minnesota that look at bad things that happen to kids when they're very little or when they are before they're born and how that affects childhood obesity?
Mr. Chair, yes. We actually, and I would be happy to come and talk more about this, but we have done studies on what we call the adverse childhood experiences. There's a set of experiences that have been sort of codified in terms of looking at those, and we do see they include The ones that they're measuring include emotional, social, physical, sexual abuse, and a parent being incarcerated.
Drug use.
Yeah, drug use. There's like 10. There's 10 things, and they're just. They were just representative. There's other things that aren't in that study, like homelessness, and you know, that we know are also connected. So it's basically created a body of work around what we call epigenetics, which is what is the connection between your beginning genetic, like opportunity and your environment, and how do these things intersect to change the structure of the brain? We can see that the more of what we call these toxic experiences or adverse experiences that a person has, the more not good things that happen in life, less success in employment, less success in education, more connection to the criminal justice system, and more chronic disease from mental health, suicide, drug use, and heart disease, diabetes. We're seeing all of that. We've got a study on it. I could come back and talk.
Yeah, I had referenced one specifically for childhood obesity that I thought was pretty interesting, but be interested to follow up more on that. And that brings us to the end of our time, and we will be talking to the commissioners of DHS tomorrow, so bring your questions for them. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.